Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm going all right. How are you?
Good. Well, folks, we are live once again with the Fight News Unlimited Combat Sports Show. This is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
And yo, 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 this is Tornado, Tony Pinnacle.
And we have a guest tonight who put together a pretty nice documentary on the Jackson's MMA training camp out there in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Landon Dykstra House is coming on at 8:30 to chat with us about that. I just watched over the last week in full, and I was really impressed. I didn't really know that much about Jackson himself and his background and the people that he has working there, so it was very interesting to get to see that and just find out more about him. And one of the most interesting parts of the whole documentary, which you can actually watch on Hulu for free, is a point where Jackson's talking about beating Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter, and actually wrestling a crocodile, and it pretty much brought him to tears, Jackson, when he experienced that, wrestling an alligator and feeling this thing's breath on his face. And it's a pretty poignant moment in the documentary, and it kind of gets into why he does what he does, and you know, why he respects the fight game. And just pretty entertaining all around. And I wonder what kind of questions he had to ask to get these kind of reactions out of people that he got on the film. And this was before John Jones really broke out as a major world champion. So it kind of predicted all that, and at the time, he was pretty much one of the most promising students that they had there. So there was a lot revealed behind the scenes there. And Landa did a great job at it. Really can't even point out anything bad about the film, except maybe there was one shooting, one part of the shooting where they had some fights in the local Albuquerque area where it was kind of jumpy on the camera angles and stuff. I don't know if that was somebody at the show filming or one of Landon's people, but that was the only really gripe I had about it. It was kind of really shaky, but no big deal. When you look at the whole picture itself, it kind of gets wiped out. But anyway, we'll talk to Landon later. We have a metric ton, of mixed martial arts news to cover. And we probably will have Tom back. Here's Tom. Tom!
Hey! Yeah, I just heard you mentioning about the dinosaur breath. That was had to be the funniest part of the documentary. Oh, classic stuff. So,
yeah.
Can't wait to talk to him.
Yeah, it was amazing that you got that kind of reaction out of him. And there was another point later where he really explained a little bit more about, you know, why he has such great respect for the martial arts and how he loves to just deconstruct things. And there was one point where he actually talked about how he never cried as a baby because he was just looking around at everything in awe and trying to deconstruct, you know, what was up with life.
Yeah, and I enjoyed the part where he really got into the metaphors about music. About art and so much of that. And I think that a key sometimes to solving problems is to look into areas outside of your area and then see what kind of bridge you can construct between the two and pull some lessons out of it. I'll say this much, he would be fascinating just to sit and talk to.
Right, yeah. I kind of feel like, you know, it would be tough to get anything out of him that Landon didn't get, though.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Good point.
Very good point.
Like, you know, I'd want to ask Landon to hook me up with an interview, but what am I going to get out of him that I couldn't write down from what he said in the interview, you know?
Yeah, and what I'd like to mention to Landon, though, is that you know, to me, a narrator, to use a fight analogy, is kind of like a referee in the sense that the job is vitally important, but you need that balance of when to just let the action roll and then when to intervene. And I think that this timing was superb because he set it up to set the tone. And then he let the fighters talk. He let the trainers talk. He let the cameras roll over the pictures, you know, the current action, and it just came out. It just was a masterpiece.
Yeah, great job. And he's living in Vegas now, so I would definitely love to see what he's working on now, if anything, in the fight game still, because that's really the fight capital of the world. So I can imagine that he's got limitless potential to go in whatever direction he wants on that scene. So we'll have to ask him about that. But one of the other things I noticed about the documentary kind of plays into the recent news that you haven't been on to talk about recently, which is the knockout loss of Anderson Silva to Chris Weidman. And there was one point in the documentary where he talks about what Jackson talks about. To me, you know, the head movement in boxing doesn't apply to MMA.
Mm-hmm.
You're not moving
right
forward. Shouldn't be moving your head. And I'd never heard that philosophy before, so that's very interesting. It makes a lot of sense, too, because, you know, obviously Anderson Silva got clipped not moving forward, but standing still pretty much and kind of leaning back a little bit.
You know, just as my 2 cents worth on the whole thing is I was so near yet so far away. The trip was half of a disaster. We had some serious problems on the way out, and my plan was, I had some cards printed up for the show, and the whole plan was to hand these cards out at the UFC Expo. Well, the problem is, by the time I got there, it was just too late, and I wasn't able to make the Expo. So, but. Well, I found interesting, and then the party went on so late that I wasn't able to even get the thing ordered on pay-per-view. But what was fascinating, the first thing that came up on the sports news in Las Vegas, and that is very, very rare to see that anywhere. So I enjoyed that. That was a classic. So
they're already set up for a rematch. I think it's December 28th. And it's going to be on the undercard is actually going to be now the Ronda Rousey versus Misha Tate fight. So that'll be interesting. I actually have some questions out to Ronda. Hoping to get an interview with her over the phone or, you know, by text. But it's very interesting that she's cool with that being the co-main event instead of the main event. There's a story that came out about that this week. And another guy that we've had on the show before and I've met in person, just got a shot on the Fox Sports 1 card up here in Boston. John Doomsday Howard just made the news yesterday. Actually, I found out on Facebook. He posted a picture of himself and Uriah Hall. And, but he's going to get a second shot at the UFC. They tossed him out after a third straight loss, even though it was pretty much every fight in that streak was against top competition. They tossed him out anyway, and it's good.
Can I
back.
Can I make some of that stupid rule again?
What? Oh, the three.
Can I make one? Yeah, the three strikes and you're out rule. Can I make fun of that again?
Yes, you can.
Okay, I'm going to give you guys a scenario. Hypothetically, say we're going back to 1998, and there was a fighter, a boxer, and you had a contract on HBO, and he lost 3 straight fights, and they didn't bring him back. And he ended up being a world champion again. How dumb would they look?
Pretty dumb.
Let's go back to this hypothetical situation. January of 1998, Arturo Gatti lost to Angel Manfredi, or sometime, or I think it was sometime in early to mid-98. Then he lost to Ivan Robinson. Then he lost to Ivan Robinson again. Arturo Gatti lost three straight fights. You know what HBO did? They brought him back. They put him in there with one fight against a guy that was, you know, pretty much a no-hoper, and he knocked him out. And then he had a fight with a guy named Joe Hutchinson, and that was on, like, ESPN2. And he beat him by decision. And then he also had a knockout of Joey Gamache in there. He got into a fight with Oscar De La Hoya, and De La Hoya beat him pretty bad. But HBO still kept him. And that's when they, he took some time off, and he came back, and he had the win over Teron Millett, who was a former world champion. And that's what got the fight with Mickey Ward, the first one. So, yeah, HBO, if they would have won with the three strikes and they're out with Arturo Gatti, would have lost out on the Gatti-Ward trilogy. They would have lost out on, some of his other fights, his knockout win over Leonard Doreen, his Gianluca Bronco, when he once again won the junior welterweight championship. They would have lost out on that. I don't know if it would have been so unfortunately for Gatti, but they wouldn't have had the fight with Mayweather, which ended up being a big revenue fight. A lot of pack houses at Boardwalk Hall never would have had them. So, what's that asshole's name again? Dana White. Once again, try to learn. Try to, stop being so egotistical and look at real life. Fighters lose.
Right.
Great one.
And, this one, it's a pretty favorable scenario for Howard. Because here's a guy who lives in Boston. The fight is in Boston. And he has tremendous experience gap over Uriah Hall. Uriah Hall, I think, is 7-3 or something like that. And he's got over 30 fights, Howard. So it should be, I think it's close to 30, not exactly over 30. So he's got a lot more experience, and he's gone 6-1 in his absence from the octagon there, and he only lost to a guy who had a 20-7 record. So he's definitely earned his shot back, and it doesn't happen that often where, especially in that short of a time period, guy is off for, I think his last fight in the UFC was 2011, so less than 2 years he's back on track, and if he wins, I'm pretty sure he's probably going to sign a contract with them and fight a few more times at least. So that's very positive for him, and more power to him. I hope he makes the best of it. I like Uriah Hall. I've gotten some interview questions from him when I was working on that story for Ultimate MMA, and I'd kind of like to see him stick around, but if it means Howard loses, I'd be happy to see him go. And earn his shot back by going through the, lower cervix and regional shows. But big story, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to be there, but ESPN Friday Night Fights is coming to Salem, New Hampshire, which is probably about an hour away from me here. But anyway, it's full of a bunch of local Brockton, Massachusetts, and that area guys. And it's highlighted or headlined by your boy Hank Lundy, Tony.
Yes. Elusive
one.
Man, have you seen the guy he's fighting?
I heard of him. I know I've heard that name.
Well, I've seen this guy only fight one time. This Jose, or however they pronounce his name. And Hank's got to be sharp. I know, I forget who posted on Facebook. I don't know if it was Teo Digest or somebody posted it on there. And a lot of people are coming out there saying, man, Hank's going to get killed. This guy's going to kill him. Good luck, Hank. I don't know if you're going to win this one. And then Hank, he popped in and goes, good. Thanks to all the doubters, dude. That's just going to fire me up even more. But this guy, Jose, whatever they pronounce his name, he took Lucas Matisse's bombs flush for 10 rounds before he finally went down. First time in his career. So Hank has to get out of his mind. Forget the knockout. If you're going to try and knock out, go to the body. But don't try to knock him out to the head. Because if it took Matisse 10 rounds, that's like going 10 rounds with King Kong. And speaking of Matisse, him and Danny Garcia just got signed today. for the Canelo Alvarez Floyd Mayweather undercard in September.
Yeah, I just posted that on the blog on Fightin'
Isn't It. Yeah, I saw that. And I'll tell you right now, a lot of people are favoring the challenger, Matisse. I even saw one person go as far on Facebook to post a picture of a gravestone with Danny Garcia's name on it and said, son of an angel.
Wow, that's rough.
He's obviously doing father, Angel Garcia.
Yeah. Well, on this Friday night.
Well, just like Hank's going to have a tough time. Hank's going to have to box, move, set his feet, hit, pivot, and this guy's going to put a lot of pressure on him. He's got a good chin. He's in good condition. He's easy to hit, but he's also got a good punch. And, you know, Hank's not known for having a good chin. In fact, unfortunately, he's known for not having a good chin. So it's going to be a tough fight for Hank there. And it's almost the same thing with Danny Garcia. You know, in that fight, he's really going to have to box a master game plan. He's going to have to let Matisse come in and walk in those punches, hit him, and then be out of there before Matisse can set his feet. It's almost like almost two similar scenarios for these two fights.
Yeah. Well, it's a packed card, too. We have a guy from the city I went to high school in, Quincy, Ryan Kielczewski. He's undefeated, 16-0, I believe, and he's fighting against Oscoris Frias in a junior lightweight fight. And Frias' record's not right in front of me, but I think he's unbeaten, too. 10-0, I believe. I think he had a... he's 13-0, but... I saw another story where it mentioned that the caliber of his opponents is pretty crappy. So Kielczewski should roll over him in this one. He was scheduled to fight somebody else who was 10-0 and had a lot better reputation in the business, but this guy's a late stand-in. Then we also have Gerald Schifoni, a guy actually I think I have on my YouTube channel one of his amateur fights, right after I broke my ankle up here in New Hampshire and went back down to Brockton. I was at an amateur event and I filmed all the fights, and I think Gerald's was one of them. And he's from Brockton, super middleweight, and he's had about 50-odd amateur bouts and won 4 New England Golden Gloves titles. So he's actually, even though it's his pro debut, he's fighting a guy who has 20 pro fights. So... that's pretty amazing. 20-plus pro bouts. And the guy's known for going the distance, a guy named Noel Garcia, who's 31 years old, from Puerto Rico by way of Springfield, Mass. And also on the card, we got 8-0 Chris Gilbert in a six-round middleweight bout against Luis Viramontes, who's 3-2-1 with one knockout. So that should be interesting from Salem. We got another fight, Brian Vera versus Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. is in the news this
week. That's a good fight. You know, Chavez should be favored in that fight, but Vera's no pushover. You know, he's a tough fighter. He's going to be right in your face. And, you know, he doesn't do anything great, but he does a lot of things well. And, he's going to give Chavez a little bit of a test for his money. I think Chavez will slip him away. But, you know, it should be an interesting bout.
And speaking of Friday night fights, guess who is promoting his very first boxing event on in August in New York?
Can I do an invitation?
Yeah.
Apparently he said this to you one time.
I don't know, man.
Yeah, Mike Tyson is going to be promoting a big card in New York. He's been working on Broadway with his live show. He's basically talking about his whole life and his biography and kind of jazzing things up. But now he's actually going to be promoting boxing. And this is interesting for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is the fact that he's going to be working sort of with Teddy Atlas, who has some bad blood with.
That is pretty interesting.
Wow.
To say the least.
From the time, 20 years ago, when Teddy put the gun to his head.
Right. So I don't think Teddy's going to be doing any interviews with the promoter.
Yeah, right.
On this one. But Arginis Mendez is going to be on this fight against Canada's Arash Usmani, who I think was the guy that was in another controversial ESPN Friday Night Fights with what's the guy's name? No, Frank. The guy with Warriors boxing, yeah. Ramses Barthelemy.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
And I thought Barthelemy lost that one.
As did most people. Yeah, Teddy won that one.
An unbeaten Claudio Marrero will take on Jesus Andreas Cuellar at featherweight in the chief support bout. And Tyson does plan to attend the card and may even take part in the televised coverage. And obviously, probably if he does, he probably will not be anywhere near Teddy, unless they've buried their hatchet, so to speak, there. We'll see. So that's it's definitely an interesting card, and we'll see how it goes for Tyson. I don't see the name of it.
You know, this reminds me of that old cliche, if you live long enough, you see and hear just about everything.
Yeah.
Boy. You know, so, yeah, I can't imagine them burying the hatchet. But I wish they would, though. It'd be interesting to get their commentary if both of them were sitting next to each other during the fights.
And they both have a little bit of a speech impediment, so it would kind of be funny to hear them both on the audio. But anyway, that's going to be a great situation there to see Tyson back in the sport of boxing in a promotional role, because I think when Golden Boy started, we got to see a lot improve in the sport of boxing because fighters were involved on the promotional side. And you know, a guy like Tyson, who has seen the good, the bad, and the ugly in boxing, is a perfect fit for that role. So I'd really like to see what he does with his chance. And I'm sure a lot of other people are really pulling the strings, and he's kind of just a figurehead of this whole thing, but I bet he also has some input. And who wouldn't want to work for Mike Tyson? I mean, come on. I think that's a bigger boss to have, or better boss to have, than 50 Cent any day. But anyway, another story here before we get Landon on, I wanted to mention. I know we don't talk about wrestling a lot, but Tony's boy Ric Flair has been in the news a lot lately this week. And he might be saying woo from jail if he doesn't pay $32,000 in support payments to his ex-wife. A North Carolina judge is ordering him to pay or go to jail on that. And he was also in the news because his ex-wife had an arrest warrant out for her earlier last week because she was apparently stalking Flair's new girlfriend. So a lot of bad blood in that domestic partnership there. We'll have to see how that unfolds. But Flair has been through a lot of bad luck lately. I didn't actually realize this, but he's recently lost his son. His son was a month with a blood clot, and he didn't go to work for 3 months, he said, and that's his excuse for not paying. And in March, the son's body was found in a Charlotte, North Carolina hotel room. And it was kind of almost exactly what happened with this guy from the Glee show. He's found with heroin and prescription drugs, and that's what he died of, combination of overdose from that stuff. So, of course, that must have broken up the father quite a bit. Kid was only 25 years old and wasn't doing any work, wasn't making money, apparently, so he wasn't in any position to pay. But he says he's willing to pay it and take care of it so he doesn't have to go to jail. But apparently the wife, Beams, the last name is Beams, I don't know. Okay, we're back. What was the last thing you heard there, Tony? I think he's got hung up at this
point. Well, you're talking about with Claire, and you're talking about he wasn't working. You know, that's why he hadn't paid his wife. And then I was going to pipe in with a comment. From everybody, I mean, obviously, I'm going to get Ric Flair in person. He actually, just a few months ago, went at the same casino Tom and I went to this last month. So that was a night I couldn't go to meet him. But they said, even back in the day, when they would have, like, some of the wrestlers would go out after some of the shows, he would always buy drinks for the younger guys, always. And they did a celebrity night swap a couple weeks ago. I DVR'd it. I haven't watched it yet, but it was Ric Flair and Rowdy Piper.
Huh.
And, you know, yeah, it was Piper's wife that he'd been married to for 30 years now, I guess, something like that, and Ric Flair's current girlfriend. And they said basically what was going to make the show interesting. Like I said, and I haven't watched it yet, but it was Flair's, you know, he's a spendthrift, you know, and Piper's really like frugal. He's pretty cheap. So now they're like saying Flair's trading his younger girlfriend to somebody who's pretty cheap. And so we'll see how interesting that was. Flair's always been just a wild spender. You should figure he really retired in 2008 after the one WrestleMania where he lost to Shawn Michaels. And then he was back literally within like a year or so with TNA. So it's telling you right there that he was already hurting for money.
Right. Well, we got Tom back here, and we got to connect with Landon Feisterhaus, who has done a documentary on Jackson's MMA out there in Albuquerque.
Yeah, I know you sent me the link. I haven't had any chance to even open the link yet. I've been so busy this week with a new job.
Right. It's pretty interesting documentary. I mean, there's a lot of interview material, but there's some fight stuff too, a little bit of boxing. Their main striking coach is a guy who was a world champion kickboxer named Mike Winklejohn, and he actually trained Holly Holm in boxing before she made the decision to go into MMA recently. So she's on the tape there.
Hello?
Landon.
Yes.
Hey, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron here. We're also on the line with Tony the Tornado Pennacal and Psychic Tom Padgett.
What's up, guys? How we doing?
Great.
Good evening, Landon.
Tom and I are really the big MMA guys on the show, although I just mentioned to Tony that Holly Holm was in your documentary, who was a pretty famous welterweight female boxer. He's our boxing guy. How did all this come together where you decided to do this documentary in the first place?
Well, it came together. I was a budding filmmaker in New Mexico and was looking for a project that was worthwhile. And in New Mexico, there's not a lot of things going on. We do have a small film industry that's pretty good. We have Green Chili and we have the Bloom Fiesta, but most notably, we have Jackson's MMA. You know, these guys are on TV every week. They're doing great things in the community. And, of course, Greg Jackson's taken a lot of the people from New Mexico and outside of New Mexico and taken them and made them better people, better athletes, better fighters. So we approached Jackson's with the idea about doing a documentary about the scene. No one has approach them at all as far as doing that kind of project, and they were interested in doing it. We had some backing from the New Mexico Film Office and the governor's office, and we were able to put everything together and get some interest from them on the project, and that's how it got rolling. They had actually been approached before. They tried, you know, there's people who tried to do a reality show with them. There were other things that misfired, and we were really lucky to get in with them because, you know, they're not big on all the cameras in the limelight.
Yeah, there was actually a part of the documentary I was kind of puzzled about where they were talking about how they had to get some stuff removed from YouTube because they were concerned about somebody had an upcoming fight and didn't want to get any intel out. So what was the in that you got that convinced them to let you guys in there?
Well, I had done various projects in the area, and I got to know the gym manager, Ricky Cotton-Steady, quite well. You know, I had done various work at different MMA venues, from DJing to even doing camera work and stuff like that. So I had good ideas coming up in the area, and, you know, with the help of the film office, and then also we were able to bring in our investor, which was the Hard Rock Fair in Albuquerque. Once we got them behind us, they really knew we were serious. But even before that, the gym had committed to working with us on the project as long as we, you know, as long as it was just Jackson's gym. You know, we had an idea to maybe cover other MMA areas and programs in the state. We went to Jackson's. They said, you can do it, but let's just stick with our gym, and, you know, you can do the film how you want to do it, and that's how it kind of evolved from there, so.
Ooh. And what did you enjoy most about the whole filming process and getting all this together?
Definitely getting to know the guys and the characters in the gym. I mean, each person plays a role in that gym that makes it function, and everybody plays a different role. So if you watch the film, you know, this guy, Crazy Steve, he's Greg's very first student. He's this old guy walking around, swinging a staff, he's swinging swords, shooting rubber band guns, and he's a full-on martial arts expert, combat expert in every sense of the word. You wouldn't think this guy was dangerous, but I'm sure back in his heyday, he was quite dangerous. But people like that, to, you know, just the family-type atmosphere, every person that comes through that gym is an important person, from the very bottom of the, you know, of the fighters who are just getting there and trying to make a name for themselves and working their ways up, to the John Joneses, you know, and everybody else who's, you know, had a lot of success in the UFC. You know, Mike Winklejohn, he's been with Craig from the beginning. You know, these guys have gone through so many battles together. So, you know, Craig's gym started, you know, just on a corner on San Mateo in Albuquerque. And from there, it's grown, you know, a couple people at a time, and more and more, until, of course, the big break, as the film talks about, was when Diego made it onto The Ultimate Fighter. And then the gym really started to pick up steam and gain recognition, as did the sport of MMA.
Yeah, that was another interesting dynamic, you know, the discussion with Diego that you were able to get. Just talking about that whole decision that he made to leave, and then later on there was the posting at the end saying that he had come back and, you know, started to do better in his career as a result. So I was intrigued by that, but one question I wanted to ask was how close to the whole John Jones and Rashad Evans war of words was this taping?
It was actually real close. In fact, I have an interesting story about that. During the time we were taping, it was right when Rashad had decided to move forward from Jackson's gym. And, of course, a lot of the speculation at that time was Rashad may have gotten a bit jealous or felt a bit insecure with Juan's arrival at the gym. You know, he was always the big dog. And, of course, this wasn't John's intention or anybody's intention at the gym. But that's what at least I believe Rashad felt at the time, and of course moved on to other training areas. But we had a part in the gym in the film that we tried to get released to use in the film, where we went up to Denver and John was getting ready to fight. I think it was Brandon Vera, and we got Rashad up there outside of the van, and we started asking him about John Jones. In fact, the clip is actually on YouTube, and he talks about, you know, he loves John as a brother and as a friend, and you can still tell there's a lot of animosity, though, in the way he answered the question, and a lot of maybe jealousy even. So that was definitely a hot topic during, you know, around the time of the taping, and unfortunately they, you know, just to show you the emotion that was still involved, Rashad and his manager would not okay that clip to be in the film. It is on YouTube now. I think it has like 60,000 views or something, but it is definitely an interesting dynamic and something Greg deals with a lot there, you know, with so many different champions and different people. You know, it's hard because some people build up an ego and that can ruin things and a family dynamic.
Yeah, I was interested to see the Winklejohn was wearing the Sugar Rashad Evans T-shirt to a lot of it.
Right. Yep, he sure was. Yeah, so I know I know the trainers and pretty much everybody at the gym has a lot of love for Rashad, and it was just an unfortunate situation. Of course, also a situation where when the media gets a hold of it, it can definitely get blown out of proportion. So I know while we were filming the whole time, there was no talk of anybody outside of the gym. You know, definitely no real talk of Rashad. So, you know, they always welcome. And as you can see with Diego, they welcomed him back with open arms, you know. So, you know, sometimes mistakes are made and people come back and fix them. But, you know, when you have a family, it's about loyalty and trust and respecting each other. So.
All right. Now, have you always been an MMA fan, or did this kind of whole experience make you one?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, yeah, my first book to be an MMA fan. We don't have pro sports out there, so fighting is the sport. You know, that's what we follow. We follow our guys getting up into the big leagues, and that's always, you know, Strikeforce, Tour, and of course the UFC, but you know, it starts at the grassroots level in Albuquerque with the King of the Cage, with other fight promotions, and then most recently the Jackson's MMA promotion has gained quite a bit of steam. I think we're going on our 11th event on August 10th, and Albuquerque will be our 11th event, and that week has you know, created guys like John Dodson and Diego Brandao, who's gone on to win the Ultimate Fighter in the UFC. So it's definitely paying dividends for a lot of the up-and-coming fighters in the area.
Yeah, I wasn't aware when I was watching that season that Dodson was a Jackson guy, but it makes sense looking at how confident he was. Now looking at seeing that he was part of the camp all along.
And a funny anecdote about that is even when we're filming with John, you know, everybody in the gym who trained with Dodson knew he was talented, had seen him fight, knew about his raw athletic ability as well as his great technical skills, you know, being with Greg for so long. And it was just a situation where a guy didn't have a shot because there wasn't a weight class in the UFC, you know what I mean?
Right.
Of course, as soon as that weight class was carved out, you saw, you know, his star emerge. But there's a lot of people like that at Jackson. There's a lot of guys who are right under the radar who are, you know, just being groomed and ready to take the next step.
All right. Anyone else got anything for our guest here? I feel like I'm hogging this one.
Well, Landon, as I was watching, I have to congratulate you on your timing of the whole thing, because I think that the narrator, to use a fight analogy, is somewhat like a referee. It's very important to set the tone, but you don't want to be the whole show. And I think the narration was just perfect. It was just enough, and not, you know, not too much, but not too little. and then you let the fighters talk, you let the trainers talk, the cameras just rolled, and everything. You know, I think a lot of people might think that that's easy. I think it's anything but that. It's very hard to get that right, kind of like being a master chef. You know, you have to just blend it right, and I think it just flowed just a masterpiece, and I really have to congratulate you on that.
We definitely appreciate that, and you know the object of the film was to capture the essence of what makes this gym so great. How do they keep winning? How do they constantly breed champion after champion? And the simple fact is, it starts with Greg and Wink at the very top, and the way they treat people, and the way they train every day, and the way they immerse themselves in fighting in the combat lifestyle. Those are all the reasons why they are what they are. It's hard work. I mean, every single day they're in there. In fact, you know, Greg and Coach Winklejohn and even, you know, Coach Luttrell, who's mentioned, who's in the movie quite a bit, you know, these guys train not only fighters, they train the combat force in New Mexico. You know, they're training. They have a new gym that's developing kids from, you know, as soon as they can walk. I mean, these guys love this. And, that's why you see so many great athletes coming out of the area. I mean, it's
right.
All environment there.
And I think you really captured the essence of the fact that there are no shortcuts. I mean, I think that, you know, I've been a lifelong martial arts student, and I know even back in the 60s when I first started, everything back then, everyone wanted the magic secret. There's got to be some shortcuts, just send away for this court, whatever. Yeah, and the bottom line, there are no shortcuts in this business. I mean, I've looked for them for a long time, found out that there aren't any, but you really did a great job with that. Now, I do have another question that came to me just out of the blue as I was watching this, that, as you said, fighting is the sport in Albuquerque. And are there other MMA gyms? I mean, Jackson's has got to be the big fish in the sea there, but are there other, is there any, like, remote competition, or does everyone pretty much just go to Jackson's? How does that work?
You know, as you can imagine, Jackson's is the biggest gym there, but there's definitely other gyms in the area. Gracie Jiu-Jitsu has a couple gyms in the area. Fit in a gym, there's a small segment about the other black belt that was part of the original black belts. His name was Tom Vaughn. He has a gym in the area, and they train fighters as well. And you know, all the people in the area, a lot of fighters do end up getting work and working with other gyms to get better. I know a lot of the guys are training jiu-jitsu and then, going to the pro class in the morning at Jackson's and then, you know, going to roll in the afternoon at Gracie and then coming back at night for another Jackson's class. I mean, that's just how it is, that people are working together. And, you know, a lot of the coaches are coming in and out of the gym working. I believe also Keith Jardine and Chris Luttrell kind of branched off and they have a gym. It's a mean one. So, yeah, I mean, it's literally a breeding ground for MMA. There's gyms popping up everywhere. There's people trying to build gyms. There's people trying to do promotions. But, of course, it all comes back to there's only, you know, it starts with the originator, and that's Greg Jackson and Mike Winklejohn. So.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes, you know, there's an old cliche in this business that you can hear the same thing maybe from a different instructor or just to put a little different slant on it, and it can make you better. That doesn't mean you have to completely cut ties with your home base, but you know, I've had that experience, too, of training in a few different places, and sometimes a light bulb goes on, and that's no knock on the main gym or the main course. But I was just kind of wondering about that as I was watching, so thanks for the insight.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the reason why these guys become, why Greg is a guru of mixed martial arts, is, and the movie talks about it quite a bit, is that, you know, these coaches were trying to evolve a martial arts style that encompassed everything, that encompassed wrestling, that encompassed striking, that encompassed jiu-jitsu way before it was, you know, hip to do. You know what I mean? A lot of people just trained one discipline in the sport. And, of course, as we've seen it evolve, you definitely have to be good at anything to survive in the octagon. So that's something they were doing before everybody else, and that's the reason why they got a leg up, so to speak.
Yeah, because if you look back on those early UFCs, it was always style against style, and all the promotion back then was how will karate do against boxing, or how does kung fu stack up against wrestling. And it wasn't until probably, I'd say, around late 95, early 96, where we seen Marco Huas and Don Fry and, you know, some of these hybrid guys. But the fact that Greg was onto that years before, that's evolution. I mean, it's just, now it's just gone, because now it seems so commonplace. But believe me, back then it wasn't common to think like that, because everyone thought my style is my way. And back in the 60s and 70s, it was even worse. It was just horrible back then. I mean, if you did one thing, that's what you did, and that's your style, and that was it. And I didn't like that back then either, but, you know, we didn't have much guidance back in those days, you know. But very good point.
You're absolutely right on that. But that just goes back to his selflessness. He didn't even get into the sports to become a fighter. He decided at the very young age, I want to train and help people. And, you know, that's what he did from the get-go. He was never in the octagon. I mean, early on, he had a little bit of a, you know, inner conflict. Should I fight? Should I train? But it was quite apparent that he knew he was gifted as a trainer, that he could help people, that he could be a very big person in the sport, in the sense of that he doesn't have to be in the limelight, but he creates the stars that are in the limelight.
Yeah, that was it was interesting to see the development from such a young age, where he was out there training guys who were sometimes twice his age in the gym.
Yeah.
You know, being so young and being a teacher. But I think what struck me was how much he's into the positive reinforcement. And I know I mentioned to Tom before that one of my favorite Jackson moment was when he was in the cage with George St. Pierre, and St. Pierre came back to the corner and started talking about his groin. He wrecked his groin and halfway through the fight, and it was probably the maddest I've ever seen Jackson. He was just telling him to shut up and deal with it. Go back and be dynamic. So
yeah, makes the training special too is that for each fighter, they will try to fill in the gaps. They don't try to change the fighter. So every person's different. So when people people have unique styles, you know, Clay Guida's high energy and bouncing around the cage, and, you know, John Jones will fight with his chin up and different stuff. But instead of, you know, trying to break down their whole style and rebuild it from scratch, they will plug the holes and make them better and work with what they're already working with to make them, you know, that much better, that much quicker. So it's very interesting to see. You know, it's not my way or the highway there. It's how can we make you better? How can each fighter reach their potential?
Yeah, with Clay, it was interesting too. I mean, you watch this documentary, and one of the things I was struck by is just sometimes you can't even tell when it was filmed. It's not like it's old news now, because you still see so much stuff that you've never seen before in MMA fighters' training regimen. And one of the parts that struck me that was relevant to today was how he was talking about head movement. I think it was with Clay Guida, and how you're always moving forward with head movement in his style and his of his philosophy. And, you know, it kind of made me think of Anderson Silva and trying to do the boxing head movement, which Jackson discourages and says that you should always move forward with it. And I never thought of it that way. So that was a good little tidbit to have in there.
Yeah, just in that part you're talking about, the scene in the movie, you know, I think he's telling one of the fighters in the movie that, you know, if you're going to stand there like a boxer, your legs are going to get kicked to shit. You know, you got to move forward and back and keep your head on a swivel. You know what I mean? And that's the difference in the Jacksons' evolution. They were evolving these type of techniques that weren't just good for one fighting style. They were good for MMA. mixed martial arts, you know, for everything that you had to be aware of once you step in the cage, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, it's definitely interesting.
Another part I found pretty intriguing was it seems like Jackson very rarely actually goes out and tries to show people anything. He mostly does everything with his, you know, his voice, basically. He just talks to his fighters and encourages them when they're doing things right and just kind of makes gentle suggestions when they're not doing things right.
Sure, yeah. I think, you know, maybe he's definitely involved in showing the fighters. A lot of times, you know, the fighter and the coach will just sit in the cage and have a conversation. You know, they won't even be training. I mean, that's how intimate it can get as far as, you know, learning and stuff like that. But, you know, a lot of times, just like you mentioned, it's about positive reinforcement and trying to fill those gaps as opposed to, you know, here, look at me, watch me do this. You know, in fact, there's a lot of coaches who end up coaching and passing on Greg's knowledge to the other fighters, and a lot of them are hands-on with the fighters. Like Clay Guida is very hands-on, you know, he'll be leading the classes. John Dotson, the same way, teaching, and then, you know, of course, when it gets time for, you know, Greg to look at him, then he'll make some more suggestions to fine-tune everything. And that's, you know, all the coaches work together in that aspect. And, you know, Coach Winklejohn is in there every day with the pads, working with each fighter, you know, and guiding them with technique and stuff like that. And, yeah, so it's, you know, that's why Greg is the strategist. He oversees everything. And then there's all the other components that come into play as well.
And with Winklejohn, I really was intrigued by that whole story about his eye. And obviously I know what you had to ask to get him to talk about that, but one of the other questions I was thinking of before we got you on was, you know, some of those really great moments in the documentary where these guys really opened up, we don't really get to hear what question you asked to get these guys to tell these stories. Did you find that they just kind of opened up and talked, or did you have to ask a lot of questions?
The gym was... you know, at first it was definitely a little bit closed down when we first started filming, and it was kind of like, yeah, you can come in here and film, but, you know, stay out of the way. Training is still the primary goal here. And so we're very keen to that and respectful of Greg and Link's wishes, because first and foremost, they are about training. They could care less about the glitz and glam of the sport. But, you know, as we started to get to know them and they realized we were really just trying to share their story of greatness and what makes them, you know, a great team, they did start to open up and let down the walls a little bit. And that's when we really got to get, you know, some of those real emotions and some of those real stories in depth that they don't usually talk about in, you know, press or media, you know, top shows or even at fights, you know. It's, you know, because they don't care to talk about themselves, you know what I mean? So that's just how they are. They're very selfless like that. So we did have to pry a little bit. And, you know, once we realized that we were just trying to document the legacy of the gym, they really cooperated quite well. So we were lucky for that.
What was some of your favorite parts of the... end product there?
I definitely enjoyed working and seeing the time we were shooting was leading up to Brandon Barrett's fight, and this is, I believe this is the only true footage of John Jones before he became a champ. And seeing his evolution and how he grew up as a fighter is really interesting, because we saw firsthand what made Greg and Winklejohn and everybody there great about that gym. And it's just, you know, you may get a great product like a John Jones or a Clay Guida. He's a transplant, or, you know, there's other guys we can name, but that doesn't mean they're going to be great. That doesn't automatically mean you're going to be a champion. So unless you're willing to learn and interact and you know, you're not going to get to that pedestal. So it was cool to see them working for Chan with the athletes and see how they work differently with different people, you know. And then also to see how those people take what they learned from them. And then, you know, like Cowboy and Leonard, you know, in the movie, it showed that, you know, their ranch is kind of like a pre-proving ground, so to speak. That's where younger fighters will come that want to get into training at Jackson's. So then they have to go through the same thing, you know, seeing if they're cut out, seeing if they're really there to fight and learn, and they have to earn their way in. But it's only because they love each other and they're watching out for each other. These guys are, you know, letting them live rent-free. As long as they're there to train and be serious, they're going to take them in and help them. So that's pretty amazing to see it trickle down through the system.
Yeah, seems like they're doing some risky things out there with all the bicycles.
Yeah, they went a little crazy life out there, firing guns and riding four-wheelers around, and, you know, I think they're bucking bulls these days and all kinds of stuff, so, yeah, they definitely live life to the fullest.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. Just riding a horse without a shirt on is risky, jeez.
yeah, make sure, right?
Yeah. But anyway,
there's lots of cool things with the gym, and then and now seeing the Jackson series grow, and seeing that be you know, basically a minor league to the UFC. You know, it's really cool because in all areas, Jackson's is really trying to evolve the fight game, and it starts from the kids at a very young age. Greg Jackson now has a belt system that was developed strictly for mixed martial arts. Belt system is implemented at the new training gym that's open to the public. So there's so many cool things going on there.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about John Jones too, because I'm kicking myself now. I was at one of his fights before he even went to Jackson's out in Connecticut.
Oh my gosh.
That Mohegan Sun, and he knocked the guy out in the first round, and I wonder how many hits that would have on YouTube if I had filmed it.
Yeah. Probably quite a few.
And, you know, it was just one of his early fights, but I could have predicted he would have ended up where he is. And I imagine Jackson had a lot to do with that, but with him, it was kind of not really a surprise, but I guess, like, it was just sort of interesting to hear Jackson sort of just say that it was given talent with anything with Jones. In your documentary, he just kind of flat out said, you know, he's just my most God-gifted fighter.
Right.
So he kind
of
very humble.
Very humble. Like I said, Greg, you know, we saw it. Greg is not there to observe the limelight. You know, he even quoted in one of the reviews we got, you know, somebody asked Greg, you know, what do you think of the film? He goes, I think I'm in it too much. I mean, that's just how he is. He's so, you know, he's so selfless, so caring, so giving. And you get a lot of quality guys and quality fighters from when you got a leader like that at the top. So
yeah, I loved hearing the story about him meeting the crocodile hunter, Steve Irwin, and how he was brought to tears by the experience of wrestling a crocodile.
Yeah, that is a classic. I mean, that just goes to show you how much he loves all aspects of combat. I mean, it's not just in the cage, it's anything, self-defense, it's shooting weapons, it's shooting guns, you know, it's being able to handle weapons, everything. You know, what am I going to do in this situation? As Greg says a lot, what are the rules, how do we play the game, and how do I get a solution, how do I get an edge on my opponent? And that's how his mind is always thinking, always, you know, how can I get the leg up?
Right. And Do you have anything going on now? I know you're living out in Vegas, and I was telling Tom earlier, you know, with that being the fight capital of the world, I would imagine it's be very easy for you to find a subject out there to continue in that realm of documentary work.
It's great being out here in the fight capital and seeing the events firsthand and running in Wanderlei Silva at the gym. I mean, it's there's fighters everywhere. There's award shows going on here all the time. Right now we are working, possibly thinking about doing another documentary, but it's a little different subject, but it's definitely an intriguing one, and I'll keep the lid on it for now because, we don't have anything on paper, but we're just working, I DJ out here as well, have a possibility we might be getting casted for a TLC reality show. At the beginning of August, if we get the green light on that. We actually already shot for the pilot, so if the president greenlights the show, I'll be casted on that, and that'll be the next adventure probably. So, but we're happy this film. We had a lot of people interested in the film, from Mark Cuban to when the UFC went to Fox Sports. We have Fox Sports interested, Spike TV, a lot of people who looked at it and just didn't seem it was a fit, and then our distributor Film Buff found the film. They had actually distributed a couple other MMA films, and we found a great home with them, and now it's out there for the world to see. Well, it's out there for the U.S. to see, and soon the world. But we're just happy that people get to enjoy the film and see what really goes on at the Jackson's Gym. So,
and now, when did you find out about the film going on Hulu, and what was that like?
Got the news, I think, the end of last week, and that was probably one of the happiest days in my life, one of the highlights of my career, because I have been with this film from its inception, and it's been a little over a 3-year process. From the first notes I jotted down in a notebook to getting funding, to getting production rolling, to editing the film, to getting it out there. And couldn't have done it without everybody who worked with us, including the Hard Rock, and, including all the producers, Artie Whittington, Nick Schuster, my little brother helped produce, Stranded Bedstrauss. And, without everybody coming together and working to get it out, we wouldn't have had it. It was an independent film, and we got it distributed by ourselves with the help of Film Buff, and so now everybody gets to enjoy it. So that was a special day, and definitely grateful and thank God all the time for that. And we hope to keep putting out more products that can hopefully inspire people to be better, to treat people better, and positive films,
Cool.
I appreciate everything, and I appreciate the MMA community taking watching the film.
And what would you say you like most about, what do you appreciate most about the sport of mixed martial arts?
Probably the sincerity of it, the genuineness. There's probably no other sport in the world where you walk in with essentially notepads, no other people to rely on but yourself in the cage. Of course, you do rely on a team, and anybody who trains MMA knows how important your training partners are, but for that moment when you are in the cage, you are out there, and it's very primal, which is cool. Everybody's instinct as a person growing up is to protect yourself and protect your family. And if someone is threatening that, then you do what it takes to get them to leave you alone. So that's what's cool about fighting in MMA. It's definitely my favorite sport to watch, and probably turn into everything, every UFC card and several Bellator and Strikeforce as well. So huge fan, and who doesn't like to see two people go at it,
Right. I imagine one of your favorite fighters has to be John Jones, but you have any other guys that you really can't miss?
Oh, man, there's a few, but I definitely have to say Clay Cleed is one of my favorites. When you get to know the Carpenter and his family, you can't help but love him, as many fans do. There's also several other people. Holly Holm is a great fighter, and you guys are going to have to watch out for her as she comes up in the MMA ranks. She's going to be an interesting fighter to watch.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about this cyborg fight never going to happen between her and Rousey, but I'm actually more intrigued about when Holly Holm gets ready to face Rousey. I think she'll be a better match with her strike.
Holly's a very tall girl. She's got long arms. Obviously, she's got great hands, and her MMA game has been coming together quite well. So she's going to be interesting. And then, all the fighters, Cowboy and Leonard, they're so gracious. They're all so humble. And it just makes you want to pull for them that much harder when you do get to work with them on a day-to-day basis for a concentrated period at a time. You know, John Dawson is a guy who nobody knew about until he won the Ultimate Fighter, and then everybody loves him. But he is the same guy from when we were filming and before that to, his well-deserved success now. So there's a lot of great people at that gym. And if you get, I'm sure if you guys have met some of the fighters, you could echo my statements.
Yeah, because Clay, I thought, actually won that fight that they gave to, his name, the Gray Maynard. And I think they knocked him for his style. And, he's just trying to fight smart. Just, using that head movement and moving around the cage a lot. And, of course, Dana White loves to emphasize, pushing the action all the time. But some of these guys really, they've had long careers and they have to think about health above anything else. So, it's a smart way to fight to try to avoid headshots, especially against a guy who can knock you out like Gray Maynard.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's always going to be that conflict of interest in the sport. The fighter's going to be taught to hit without getting hit, and Dana White is on the business side. He wants to make the fans happy, so he wants to see someone get hit hard, get knocked out. So, there's always going to be a conflict of interest there. It's just how it goes.
Now, I know there was a couple of shots of guys getting knocked out, guys dealing with, nagging injuries and stuff like that. How much of that did you see behind the scenes that did it all trouble you that, these guys are taking such a beating just in training and stuff?
Oh, yeah, quite a bit. I mean, there's one scene where Carlos Conich training, he did well, but that actually wasn't the worst of it. That week when he was training as well, he's having a major neck issue where, either a disc or something in his spine was pinching, and he was still training every day. And to see the, the real pain on his face going through that, it shows how tough he is. And, of course, we've seen him in his last few bouts, and even though, he got a loss, we all know he's a winner, He probably gained even more respect out of those fights with, Hendricks and GSP, and that's just the kind of guy he is. He's just tough as nails, so... there's quite a few people like that. Donald Cerrone talked about when he cut his stomach open and, is still training and didn't let it slow him down one bit, A lot of stories like that. There's the guys fighting with the girls, you see Holly's nose beaten in and she's bleeding and keeps getting up and training. Let's go. Another round. So
right.
It never stops.
Yeah, we just talked to a female MMA fighter last episode, and she was talking about having to fight in most gyms with men all the time, and I think that's part of the reason why when women fight, they bring everything to the cage, and they don't just fight for themselves or for the win. It's like they're fighting for all of womankind when they go in there and battle. So.
Yeah, Julie Kedzie as well. I mean, if you see her in the wrestling drill, she's wrestling with the guys and eating them and just, you know, going toe-to-toe with other pro fighters, you know, of the opposite sex. It's pretty amazing to see how well they do. And that's why you see the women's side of the sport really gaining popularity quickly, because even in the Jackson series, a lot of times we'll have a couple women's fights on the cards, and they're the most exciting fights of the night. And that's just because they're very tough and they have something to prove. Like you said, you know, they are fighting for the growth of the sport, you know, for their gender, you know, so it's cool to see.
All right. Anybody else got anything?
Hard for me to say. I didn't have a chance to watch any of the documentary or read anything, you know, working all week. You know, I was punted over the top.
Punting. He's punting. You're done.
Well, I think, Rich, that your comment was, as far as interviewing Greg, there's really not much you could say that didn't come out on the documentary. So I thought that was pretty insightful on your part. And it says volumes about how good things came out. So not much else to add.
That's great. Well, we appreciate the time. And, you know, for everybody listening, go check out the film called Proving Grounds. It's out on Hulu.com, HULU.com. And it's free to watch. So you just go to Hulu, you search for The Proving Grounds, and the movie comes up. And, you know, it's available in the U.S. right now, and then it will be available worldwide in December. It will also be coming out on iTunes, Amazon, and Netflix. So, you know, we encourage everybody to go check it out and make a decision for themselves what they think about the gym. And we also have a fan page on Facebook, too. It's facebook.com/TPG movie, like The Proving Grounds TPG movie. That's the URL handle for Facebook and the Twitter as well. So if, you know, anybody can leave a comment on what they think of the film, what they like best, what they didn't like, and start a conversation that way as well.
Awesome. Is there anybody you want to give a shout out to or thank or anything like that before we let you go?
Yeah, definitely want to thank Harbaugh for, you know, giving us the financial backing to make this film come to life. Greg Jackson for letting us step into his gym, and Ricky Palmetti, who is the gym director there. He was basically our go-to guy for everything we needed from Greg and the rest of the fighters, and he made it very easy for us. And of course, all the D-House Entertainment production and our distributor Film Buff for getting the film out there. So we appreciate everybody and everybody else that's been involved along the way.
Yeah, you definitely did a very thorough job. What I was really impressed with was you even got Governor Bill Richardson to sit down and talk to you about mixed martial arts. I think that's probably the best thing to happen to MMA. To get somebody like that to say something good about it after John McCain called stock fighting.
Yeah, that's right. And Governor Richardson was a huge fan because Carlos's dad, Brian Condit, also worked in Santa Fe with Governor Bill. So they were really close and big advocates for the sport. And also, you know, they helped get a lot of the a lot of stuff sanctioned early on in New Mexico, so there could be, you know, MMA fights and different promotions able to throw events without being hassled too much. So
I think they might need to send him into New York. I know he's been overseas to deal with hostage and stuff. So. Maybe they can send him to New York to legal out there.
Yeah, you wonder when they're finally going to get it right up there. It's like, you know, and when it does, it's going to be huge. They're probably do a super fight there. But there's actually, you know, there's a documentary on that too. It's about MMA in New York and touches on some interesting points about legislation and stuff. So we'll see.
All right, Landon, well, we'll let you go. I definitely appreciate talking to you. I love the film. I think that, you know, it really gives you an insight of, you know, what guys have to go through, especially the points where they talk about suffering, you know. You suffer, you don't have to suffer in the fight. And, you know, it's kind of adds new dimension. And the fact that it's coming out on Hulu now is great because of the whole fight or pay debate, you know, and you know, it gives you a perspective that you don't normally have just watching the fight. Seeing what these guys have to go through, and I give them all the credit in the world for choosing that lifestyle, and I think they all ought to get paid a little more for putting them out there like that.
Definitely. Well, we appreciate you having us on the show. Thank you very much, Rich. Thank you so much for putting it together for us. We appreciate everything. So.
I'll definitely keep in touch, and if I get back out to Vegas at some point, we'll definitely have to hang out tonight and chat some more.
Absolutely. We'll definitely grab one for a coffee. If you're coming to town, let me know.
All right. And good luck with everything.
All right, guys.
Keep us posted on what you got coming up.
Will do. Thank you very much. We appreciate everything. And go check out the Proving Grounds, everybody.
Good one. Okay, so that's Landon Dysterhouse, and you can actually find him on Twitter, too, or on Facebook. You got a Twitter page, too? We'll probably find out on a Google search. Easy enough. But, yeah, it's a great documentary. I loved watching it, like I said, and, you know, it was great to get the behind-the-scenes report, too, on what it was like putting that all together. The works there. But, of course, we got way more combat sports news to talk about, and I want to get right back to boxing. I saw an interesting story today out there about Guillermo Rigondeaux. He's kind of found himself in the same position as Andre Ward. Nobody wants to fight him now because he sort of demolished Nonito Donaire back on April 13th in an HBO fight at Radio City Music Hall in New York. And basically, he just can't find a fight. Even though his promoter is Bob Arum, one of the biggest guys in the sport. And it's tough. And Donaire, obviously, a very great fighter. A lot of people expected more out of him in that fight and just didn't deliver. But it goes to show you how talented Rigondeaux really is, I guess. So he has no fight scheduled, and HBO executives aren't burning the phone lines trying to arrange one either, for some reason. So he met with top-ranked president Todd DeBoeuf, met with Rigondeaux Tuesday, and they're hoping to include him in one of top-ranked pay-per-view shows in the second half of the year. And they, one of those shows is scheduled for October 12th in Las Vegas. And it's going to be headlined by Timothy Bradley and Juan Manuel Marquez. And there's another one in November from Macau, China, between Manny Pacquiao and Brandon Rios. So we might see him on the undercard of one of those fights. But we don't know who's going to be brave enough to face him. We'll have to see. And here's a story. Speaking of Pacquiao, Freddie Roach came out this week in a big interview with Kevin Ioli from Yahoo and said that Manny's going to retire if he gets KO'd again. Obviously.
I wouldn't discredit that, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that.
Right.
He's had a long career, and not only, was he, knocked out, pretty brutally in his first fight with Marquez, but he did have two knockout losses early in his career. Pretty tough knockout losses. And the fact that with his style, he's not a Floyd Mayweather type of style where he was, getting, not often taking much punishment. Most of his fights, he was relatively dominant. you know, go back and look at, he had, well, four, you know, tough fights with Marquez, took a lot of punches in all four fights. His first fight with Eric Morales was, you know, relatively tough. And even some of the fights that, you know, he won, like fights like Margarito and Cotto, those were still some big, strong guys that, you know, even if they weren't landing a lot of punches, they still did land some punches. So if he does take another stoppage loss, especially if it's pretty concussive like the Marquez knockout was, yeah, it would be advisable to, you know, maybe call it a career. Got a lot of money. Got political aspirations.
Roach says it's over 100% if Pacquiao gets knocked out by Rios, his next opponent. And he also said, we have a deal. When I tell him it's over, he'll say it's over and that's it. He's pretty loyal with his words, and if that happens, it will be the end. Roach isn't really expecting to anytime soon. He's just saying.
I'm trying to remember the fighter, the exact fighter that it was. And I'm drawing a blank on that right now. It was relatively recent where the trainer came out and said, you know, you lose again, if you get knocked out again, it's over. I'm not training you no more. I forget if it was one of Buddy McGirt's fighters. I don't know. But it was like, I'm not training you no more. You know, your career's done. And then the fighter in turn did get beat again. I think he was knocked out again. And the trainer kept his part of the deal. The fighter didn't. The fighter went out and was able to, you know, hire somebody else and try to continue his career. And if my memory serves me correct, I can't remember who it was, but I remember it was not a necessarily a successful continuing of the career.
Right. And you mentioned Margarito. He was in the news this last week because he's apparently started running again and has been talking about a possible comeback to boxing, although it doesn't sound like he's very serious about it. He's at least thinking about it, but we'll see that it's going to come to fruition. And the UFC made some news last week. They announced that they've signed a multi-year deal with venues in Macau and Singapore to stage MMA events in the region starting next year. And they're going to start with the Venetian Resort Hotel in Macau and Singapore's Marina Bay Sands next 2014. And they're also going to produce a Chinese version of The Ultimate Fighter.
Nice.
I don't know if it's going to be like a kung fu movie where the lines, if they translate it to English and the lines are all off, but it'd be funny to see. But Macau's turning into a pretty big casino area, I know. I've read a lot about that, and, you know, there's a lot of Las Vegas casinos getting involved over there, so it doesn't surprise me. We'll see how that works out. I think it'll be great for them. They actually supposedly got involved with the Abu Dhabi folks just so they could expand to areas like China and Singapore, so... that was one of the main reasons motivating that deal, other than money. So I guess this is a part of that coming to fruition. And we'll see. I think it's a good fit out there. I know Japan is probably the biggest hotbed for MMA in that region, but you know, China has so many people there that would love to. You'll be able to see live events that I think it's a good fit for them. Then they can really say they're the fastest growing sport in the world. Now, I think we talked last week. Well, I know we talked last week about Brian Stann retiring, but I didn't have access to this article last week where we had a lot of these quotes. We didn't talk about his direct quotes about you know, his decision to call it quits and start doing more commentating for both football and USC. He says, if you look at my life, I've been getting hit in the head since I was in second grade playing football. I'm now 32 years old. That's a long time, and there's only so long that I can roll those dice and be successful. For me, the risk is not worth it. I'm very, very lucky to have other options. So, you know, we talk about fighter pay and things like that, but, you know, I don't think we talk often enough about the dangers involved in combat sports and, you know, how few people out there in these sports have opportunities like Stan does. And if they did, they would probably go the same route. You know, it's kind of unfortunate that a lot of these guys don't develop any second talent. They go all out in fighting or nothing, you know. So I would encourage more guys to kind of expand their horizons and do more outside their sport so that they don't end up in that position where they're old and gray and nothing can be done to get them out of a rut. You know, and it doesn't just happen in boxing and MMA either. I just read a story about Dante Culpepper, ex-quarterback for a bunch of teams. He had his house go into foreclosure. I don't know if he's in really dire straits. It did say that he has another house. But, you know, these guys, they get used to making so much money, and then when they don't have that money anymore, it's all downhill. So I hope he...
Without a backup plan, like you were saying, without a plan B.
Right. So he says, I'm very, very lucky to have other options. I've maintained a full-time job the entire time I was a fighter just because things like this could happen. You never know how successful you can be fighting. I got some other options, and I think it's time I focus more on them. Dana White has been very supportive. We talked briefly about it, but he was extremely supportive. I hope the UFC will continue to allow me to be involved in any way possible. And Stan retires with a... open six record and three UFC fight of the night bonuses, the last of which he earned in his final fight, which was a two-round tooth and nail loss against Wanderlei Silva. Bam! And he said, Dan said, sometimes it takes losses to make you think in a different perspective as well. Losing that fight, I invested so much time, I trained so hard for that fight, I never, never saw myself flipping and I lost. Because who I lost to and when I lost it, second loss in a row, it knocked me back down the last bit. Out of the top 10 in most games, it would take a lot of fights to get me back to that level again, to where I compete for the big dollars, the big contracts, get to a title shot, and all of those things that ultimately help you provide better for your family. When I look at that and the timeline and the things associated with it, it's not the most intelligent decision for me as a father to continue doing it. One of those things where I need to look at it, because my fighting style, I'm not going to change that. It's who I am as a person. It's not a healthy fighting style. It's not a fighting style that's going to give you a long career. It's going to give you a career that's about as long as the one that I have. I think the best decision for a guy like me is to walk away at the right time. So there you have it. And he also noticed, like I said, like we were talking about with Landon, about the training, the toll the training takes on you. You know, earlier in your career, he says you can take punches in sparring and take punches in fights that don't even faze you. As you do it over time, and years, all of a sudden in sparring, you start to maybe have some headaches here and there. You start to realize this isn't exactly the best thing for your health. I think there's going to be a paradigm shift in the way mixed martial arts fighters train. And he says he hasn't had any personal issues with head injuries or anything. That sort of thing, but he does have a number. He doesn't have a number of documented concussions, but he does say that you don't know when there's something wrong until there is something wrong. And he's also got kids. He's just brought his third daughter. His third daughter into the world. So he had to think about that when he was making his decision, and. I think he made the right choice. Probably, you know, it's going to be tough to, you know, give up those opportunities to make a little bit more money. But, you know, I don't think his pay is going to be stingy working for Fox Sports covering ACC college football games. He'll probably make a pretty decent paycheck doing that, too. And he won't have to get hit in the head to do it. So we'll see. I definitely think he's going to be sticking around the UFC as far as commentating those events. So we'll see him there. But a great career all in all. Also, in the news last week, it's finally official in Connecticut. Governor Daniel P. Molloy signed a bill into law that lifts the ban in the state, and it starts on my birthday, October 1st. So matches right now are only permitted at Connecticut's Indian-run casinos and illegal in the rest of the state. So October 1st, all that will change. And another big fight change this week made the news in the UFC. TJ Grant suffered a concussion in training camp. So he has had to back out of his fight with Benson Henderson, which means we are going to see a rematch between Anthony Pettis and Benson Henderson. So that was the fight that showcased the immortal Showtime kick, which actually I think he learned from the Ong Bak movie series. A dynamic type of striking that guy does. I talked actually with Duke Rufus recently, within the last few months, about how he developed working in the camp. And I'm excited to see this one. I know that Pettis has evolved quite a bit since that fight. And I think that it's definitely a great opportunity for him. I don't think he was thinking he would have this opportunity this soon, but more power to him. I hope he does good. I have nothing against Henderson, of course, but I know that he's really excited about this Pettis, and I think it's going to be a great fight. A very easy
I'll have to say this much. Pettis has no shortage of self-confidence from the interviews I've read. He feels that he has evolved so much since the first time. And then we'll get on the question is, as far as in a rematch, that the guy who loses may have the edge the second time around because he can make more adjustments. But this will be interesting to see what strategy Dick Rufus comes up with. So I'm like you, Rich. I can't wait. I believe that's August 31st. Is that correct?
You are correct. It's UFC 164, and it's coming from the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Harris Bradley Center. So,
Pettis' hometown.
So, yeah, that's another part of it that he's probably thrilled about, fighting in Milwaukee. That's where the gym is. That's where Big Rufus trains him. So, all around, that's great for him. It's kind of like John Howard must be thinking about and feeling right now, knowing that he's going to be fighting in his hometown in August. And
you remember, though, what Forrest Pettis had told us about that in some ways he felt that there was even more pressure on him fighting at home in one sense. I mean, of course, you get to sleep in your own bed and you don't have the travel problems and all that, but sometimes that pressure, and especially with the crowd behind you, might encourage you to take a few more chances. So it could work the other way. So it'll be fascinating to see.
In Howard's case, I think he might not have even gotten the call if he wasn't a resident of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
I think that worked in his favor because of, this is a second fighter to pull out of this fight, and now you're just weeks away from this event. And how are you going to find a replacement? Well, you got to go to a guy who has nothing to lose, basically, and everything to gain by taking the fight. And he's at home. He's right there in the area. So I think that worked in his favor. I think they might have brought him back anyway. But I remember when he first left the UFC, he made some comments on Facebook and, was very pissed about the fact that they treated other fighters with the same type of situation a lot differently, namely Dan Hardy. And I actually pointed out to him the reason that they kept Dan Hardy around was because he was sponsored by Zenergy, or Zions. And it was actually Lorenzo Fertitta was the one that came out and said that they were keeping him. It wasn't Dana White. And the Fertittas own Zenergy and Zions. So I pointed that out to him, and I wrote a whole article about that. And I just actually wrote a new article for Rant Sports about how they now invited John Howard back. But he was very critical of the whole three strikes you're out thing and comparing it to other guys who had losses against real pushovers and still were kept by the UFC. And sometimes you see situations like where they play favorites. I mean, I don't think he's had three losses in a row, but you look at a guy like guy who just fought there. I'm drawing a blank on the guy's name, but just fought on the last UFC card, and he got an exemption for Suboxone. We talked about this last week. Why can't I think of his name? But I thought, you know, he had a chance of getting thrown out of the UFC if he lost that fight, and he lost, and they didn't throw him out. And Dana White actually said beforehand he wasn't going to throw him out because, you know, he has a soft spot for him. He really likes watching him fight. Driving me nuts. I can't think of his name. He's come into a couple of his fights with orange hair. What's his name, Tom? Help me out here. I want to say Chris something. What the heck? Hold on, let me get a shirt, dog. I'll find out. But anyway, John Howard, one of the things I love to... Oh, Tom dropped off the call, man. That's why. Tom.
Okay, I'm back. I've been cut off twice here. We got a little technical issue, I guess, but I'm back. And, yeah, I know that it's on the tip of my tongue, and I can't think of it either, so I guess Sure Dog's going to have to save the day here for us.
And one of the things I like to point out a lot about John Howard is I know the Boston Marathon bomber is getting a lot of you know, front page news, I guess you could say, these days because of the Rolling Stone story there. But the guy, his brother, the guy that was killed in the whole shootout there in Massachusetts, was actually training at the same gym as John Howard, and John Howard broke his nose in a sparring session where he didn't even bother wearing a mouthpiece because he was so cocky. So I bet you that was that was a big help in getting Dana to bring him back to the UFC, Dana being a Boston native and all, and I know he donated to the charities involved in that. So I think that kind of elevated his status, I guess, as a fighter, getting wrapped up in that whole story in a good way. So that's one positive, good positive thing you could say about John. All right, so look this up on Sherdog. And we don't have a big UFC event until July 27th here. As you can see, 162. It's going to be a pretty big event. But we did have an Invicta card I watched last weekend. That was pretty entertaining. We had the return of Chris Cyborg back to the women's MMA scene. And I hate when you got crappy reporters involved in trying to push fights that are never going to happen because, of course, right after that fight, between Marlos Kunin and Chris Cyborg Justino, I guess she's calling herself now because she had a divorce. Everybody's talking about when Ronda Rousey's going to fight Chris Cyborg. And we've been through this. If you're somebody that really follows MMA closely like I do, you know not to go out there and try to write a story about when that fight's going to happen because they've already pretty much decided that it's not going to happen. Number one, you got Tito Ortiz managing Chris Cyborg. He's got bad blood with the UFC. Number two, the weight issue. She's definitively decided, Cyborg has, that she cannot drop the weight to get down to Ronda Rousey's weight class. Ronda Rousey has refused to fight at a catchweight. So they're never going to fight. It's not going to happen. Unless one of those two things changes. So I don't think it's gonna happen. And she's not even signed by the UFC. She's in Invicta. She signed a long-term deal with Invicta. That's when it's going to happen. You know, it's not going to happen.
So, Rich, you're implying there's a little sloppy journalism going on behind the scenes, huh? We have some reporters not doing their homework, huh? You know.
Oh yeah.
Well, it's like, it's kind of unfortunate because you got MMA. It's still kind of a new sport compared to boxing, baseball, football, hockey. It's very new. So you got a lot of these guys that are only working because they've become sort of, you know, mainstream in MMA. And, you know, they claim to be experts, but they don't have any common sense when it comes to these things. And they don't do enough research. They just suggest something like, you know, this would be cool if it happened. So I'm going to write a story that this is next. This is the only fight that makes sense. Or, you know, some stupid headline that they put on it to justify writing about it. And it has no possibility of happening. But they do it anyway. It's like, you know, where did you go to school where you learned that was going to be okay?
Yeah.
You just go out there and put people's hopes up on something that just makes no sense. Anyway, I'm on the Chris Lieben. That's who it was. That's who I was thinking of a while ago when I was talking about fighters who are kind of given the double standard there. And you get guys like him who are names, just you know, regardless of how you fight, but it's, you know, how, what kind of fans you have. And he does that. That was his third loss in a row at UFC 162 to Andrew Craig. You know, I like watching him fight when he goes all out, but he does seem to be losing his step. And if you're going to hold a lot of these guys to the standard after your third loss, you're going to get thrown out. How do you justify keeping these guys around in situations where they stick around just because they have a name? Because they've been there for a little while. I mean, I don't get it. I don't want to see the guy lose what he loves best, you know, to go out there and fight in the cage. But I see a guy like John Howard get thrown out after three losses, and, you know, I'm shaking my head. You know, it all depends for Dana White usually on how you go about it. You know, what kind of fight you put on. And he lost a unanimous before this loss, latest loss. This was a split decision. He had a TKO, his corner stopped the fight in, against Mark Munoz back in 2011. And his last win was a very quick one against Wanderlei Silva at UFC 132 back in July of 2011. So it's been over 2 years now since he's had a win. So it just kind of makes me wonder.
Well, and also you have to look at how long that Dana wanted to get rid of John Fitch. Now, how long did that go on? And even though Fitch was pretty successful for the most part, Fitch had quite a winning record, and finally Dana was able to get rid of him. But, you know, you got to wonder about that. And I don't know if it's just that stylish, you know, the whole style situation.
Well, I think that had a lot.
Maybe that's the same with Howard now.
You can't forget that they had bad blood dating all the way back to when Dana threw him out for one night, basically, because he wouldn't sign the lifetime rights away for the video game series they were trying to put out there. I think that had a lot to do with it, because they just couldn't come to terms on that, and then finally, you know, rather than face a lawsuit or whatever, I think they made up their minds and kind of had a meeting of the minds, I should say, and patched that up. But I think their relationship was never the same after that, and I don't think Fitch was ever a real company man, even though he decided to cave on that issue and give up rights. I think he always kind of had a grudge after that. I got a couple other stories here. Nick Diaz back in the news. Of course, he's another guy who's had a few losses in his last few fights, but he's going to get another shot back in the octagon. Dana White is apparently ready to give him a fight. The news just came out today that he has an offer on the table. Nobody's saying what it is quite yet, but he does have a potential fight in the works. We'll have to see who that is against and whether he sticks around after that. I'm sure if he wins, he will. But we don't even know who he's going to fight yet, so I guess that's kind of premature.
Well, now hold the press here, because on on the Underground in the news, the first story, White, no bout offer made to Nick Diaz. So it looks like we got rumor and counter-rumor going around here.
Well, apparently what I read is Nick Diaz was just out in Vegas. And so he just came back from Vegas and apparently had an offer he was given, but he wasn't allowed to talk about. So,
well, now, according to this, it's, and I'll quote here, a day after Cesar Gracie told BJPenn.com that UFC President Dana White had offered Diaz a return UFC fight, White told MMAFighting.com on Thursday the opposite. Nobody at the UFC talked to Gracie or anyone else that reps Nick, White wrote via text message. In response to a text message asking who the UFC offered Diaz, Gracie told MMAFighting.com Wednesday night, can't tell you. So I guess that's the latest. We'll see.
Well, that's interesting the way he worded that, because maybe he didn't tell Gracie or anybody managing Diaz, but maybe he did give Diaz a name as a possibility, and he just doesn't want it out there because nothing's official yet. You know? Who knows? Dana White has done stranger things. But Diaz actually did kind of make this remark off the cuff that he wanted another fight, and it was on Instagram, of all places, that he made the statement. And it was in the context of, oh, I just broke up with my girlfriend. I want to go back to fighting. So you never can tell, you know, whether he's serious about these kind of things when he says it in that context. But he has a 26-9 record with one no contest, and he was on an 11-fight winning fight. So I'm sure they won't find it difficult to find a fight for him, but I just wonder whether his heart's in it, because it just doesn't seem like it's a good move for him to go back to fighting, you know, unless he goes up against somebody that's a real tomato can or somebody that he could definitely beat. And then he could use that momentum to help build his own war MMA promotion. Because I think he would be better off trying to build that rather than going back. All right, so I thought Shamrocks were supposed to be lucky, or those four-leaf clovers, different story, I guess. But I was just mentioning the Shamrocks, and we got cut off. Shamrock Brothers, Frank and Ken, have made up. They had some issues over the years. I know they're adoptive brothers, but they had a falling out there, too. Back in the 90s, we've had both of them. I've interviewed both of them personally. I know, Tony, you were on the show when we had Ken on.
Yeah.
And I interviewed Frank a couple times before that, but not in a while. It's been a while for both of them. Ken was last in the news for pulling out of a fight over in the UK between one of his rivals over there who's been calling him out for years. But now I guess Ken and Frank have been paired up with a new project. They're not really saying what it is, but it's something to do with documentary or televised, something with a reality show or something along those lines. And apparently the feud is over. So Frank Shamrock came out and talked about it recently. He says, we'll see where it goes. There's a business opportunity that got us sitting down for a couple of hours. It was really nice. It was very positive for both of us. And like I said, they won't reveal what it is. But Frank said, it feels good to put it behind you, to move on emotionally, kind of have that feeling of rest. That's the best part of me. It's a new chapter. We need to move on. And it's been a long time. So we'll definitely have to see where that goes. But it's good news. I'd like to congratulate the two of them for me, I guess. And maybe we'll try to have one or both of them back on the show sometime. I did start watching that Fight Master show a little bit more religiously. I watched it last night. And it's actually something I meant to mention to Landon, is that other than his documentary, that show is really the first time we get to see how Greg Jackson coaches. And I thought it was kind of interesting last night how he was trying to tell his guy he was winning the round, even though it really wasn't that last round of the fight. And he was screaming everything positive, even in that situation, telling him that he was beating the guy in kickboxing. And it was a close fight. That's probably the best fight I've seen on that whole series so far. And it really did come down to the last second if that kid had gotten the takedown and done some damage instead of getting damaged. I think he could have won that fight.
Yeah, but I would agree. It was that close, definitely.
One of the best aspects about that was how they hyped it up as, oh, you're fighting this kid who has got no gas tank, and I've got the best gas tank in the house, said the kid who lost.
Yeah. And, you know, it was interesting because Chris Lozano, who trained in my old gym, because he's from around here, and then there was some internal stuff going on. I don't know, since I'm not training there now, but he left my old gym and went out to train at Jackson's. And then he wound up back here to train at another gym in this area, and then he went back and had the chance to go back with Greg and went over to Frank Shamrock. I found that kind of interesting, just as a little side note to the whole show.
Right. Very interesting. Well, I think we've gotten through all the major stories that I have. We talked a little bit about Friday night fights, but Tony, do you know if anything boxing related is going on for Saturday or Sunday?
Let's take a look here. I'm pretty sure nothing's going on for Sunday. I'll tell you, while I'm looking that up, what I did see pretty interesting on a boxing Facebook page today. Sometimes they'll do like fantasy dream matchups, like similar to, you know, what I used to write. And this one I thought was a joke, to be totally honest. A prime, Julio Cesar Chavez, the father, versus Adrian Broner.
Well, father would kill him in his prime.
Here are some of the comments. First, on mine, I said the matchmaker who put that fight together should go to jail. Because Chavez would beat him brutally. And then I emphasize brutally, somebody else, and this is, okay, maybe a little bit tasteless, but he said, hopefully the fight's in Florida, so you can have another situation where his Hispanic male, got a little bit of a younger black male who he felt was threatening him, and instead of shooting him, he bludgeons him to death. That's the only state where he could be acquitted. Looking at the box rec for Saturday night, I really don't see anything, at least in the States. Doesn't look like anything's going to be on HBO or Showtime. Let me just take a look over at some of the Kingdom. I have two fights, like Dario Sullivan versus Billy Joe Saunders, and a fight that I'm somewhat interested in is Derek Chisora, who took one of the Klitschko brothers, Vitaly, the distance in losing a decision. Now, he was on a three-fight losing streak. He won his last fight. He got knocked out by David Hay back last July, just about a year ago, and he's fighting Malik Scott, who's undefeated. But virtually untested, Malik Scott, who's coming off a bogus draw versus Vyacheslav Gladyskov, which everybody thought he won pretty handily. That's really the only blemish on his record. He's 35-0-1 with 12 knockouts. He's not a big puncher. He's a Philadelphia kid. That's how I know him. But like I said, he's going overseas defending Keith Thore, who's you know, a pretty big guy. Trying to see what else we got for this week, and that's really all I'm seeing. Just, you know, one fight over in the UK that might be televised on like Epics or something like that.
Well, then I guess one story I forgot to mention I should bring up now before we run out of time. Edwin Rodriguez, another former guest of ours, just won the $1 million Super 4 challenge there over in Monte Carlo. And that moved him up to number 4 in the division, or in his weight division at least. So it's time for him probably to step up to get a bigger fight, I think. He got $600,000 to beat Denis Krejcev, who had beaten the probably the top seed in the tournament, Zolt Erdai, before that, gave him his first defeat. So that was pretty impressive. Krejcev isn't really he's kind of moved up the ranks pretty fast. He's like 13-2 or something. So it's not the kind of record you would expect for a guy to come in and beat the guy like the old Erde, but he did. And then next fight, he ran into Edwin Rodriguez, and Rodriguez knocked him out in the first round with, I think, like 10 seconds left to go. So pretty impressive for him. And I know that I just read today that they're talking about a September fight in Boston, somewhere at the TD Garden, I think. He would headline, but they haven't mentioned his opponent, Rodriguez's opponent. I would think he needs a bigger test. I know that looking at the rankings, a lot of those guys that are around him are really tough, would be really tough opponents for him. Even though he's undefeated, I wouldn't be afraid that he'd take his first loss against any of those guys either. Even if he had to go over to Germany and fight a guy like Robert Stieglitz, I'd love to see that because he definitely deserves a step up and a bigger named fight. And Andre Ward even wouldn't be out of the question, I don't think. Although I don't think he would want to fight Andre Ward so soon. Maybe he'd be better off fighting some of his common opponents. They don't have any yet, but you know, there's plenty of guys out there. I think that they could put him with and pay him at least $1 million. But he definitely should be making 7 figures from here on out. We'll see. And with that, I guess that's all for us. We got a minute left, so thanks for Landon Dykstra House, and check out his documentary on Jackson's MMA, The Proving Ground, on Hulu. And until next week, when we'll try to get a boxing guest on for once, we will see you then.
All right, guys. As always, let's enjoy the fights.
Hasta la vista, baby. I got to get some sleep. My poor brain is tired from this week. I'm actually, you know, working. So until next week, I'll try to have Venus more info and be a little bit more in the game.
All right. Okay, so that's all, folks. Adios. Thanks for stopping by.